live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Final day of our retreat, and a lot of wonderful things have happened. And we'll be sharing just one person's experience and to give you an idea of what's possible in this world. I'm a big believer in faith and hope and opening the door for possibilities for people. If we're living with illnesses that are not going to be reversed or improved upon by mainstream medicine, wouldn't it be nice to know that there are other ways of approaching it? So we'll have a listen in as someone gives us their spontaneous impressions of what happened during this week. I think you'll find it interesting. We're going to talk about how anger is actually more harmful to your health as you age than sadness, from Concordia University. We have about 15 other studies to share with you as well. And I don't know if I'm going to have time today to go to the questions people have. If not, I certainly will on our next program, because I don't know how long this particular comment is going to be. We won't get to our toxic culture of education and what we need to do to change it today, but that's one of the topics I'm going to focus on. We will have a guest in the second part of our program today, and because I want you to have a different perspective on a given topic, and this topic is spiritual and Buddhist teachings and ethics for facing our ecological crisis. It's just a different way of understanding. We must at some point come to the reality of living in harmony with nature, not exploiting it, not trying to conquer it, and then becoming a victim of our own hubris. Joining us today will be Professor David Loy from Colorado. He is a philosopher, a professor, an ethicist, a Zen Buddhist teacher, and he taught in philosophy in Japan at Bunkyo University. He lived for 20 years studying with his principal Zen teacher. And he's going to share some of the insights that he's gained so we can look differently at the world we're in, especially at a time of environmental crisis. That's our program, so we have a lot to share. We're going to get right into it. And as we always do, we start with the latest on health and healing. We seem, at least it's my impression, to be a very angry nation at this point. Anger can be very constructive if it is not internalized, where you harm yourself, or thrown against someone else, another individual or group, because of what you're concerned about. Anger becomes important when it awakens us, when it tells us that something is wrong. We can be angry at our overweight. We can be angry at a heart attack. Why did I have a heart attack? Could I have prevented it? It can be anger if we go broke. Did I make inappropriate financial choices? Did I buy things I really didn't need but simply wanted? Was I aware I might not be able to pay for all this in the future? And then you get angry. But in and of itself, that does not provide important spiritual and emotional and life lessons. It's when we can stand back and detach from a moment, don't personalize it, and simply say, what is the message in this that I must learn? This is an important lesson. Instead, from my own personal observations of counseling tens of thousands of individuals and in groups, health support groups. I did a health support group on anxiety and depression. Many of you were in it. 500 of you began it. And over 400 completed it about 3 years ago. And anger was one of the most common issues that people said that they could not resolve because it was outside their control, they felt. Circumstances outside their control. One woman, I remember distinctly because she got up in front of the group and she said, "I'm angry because I'm getting older and there doesn't seem to be anything I can do to change it, and I don't like how I feel, I don't like how I look, I don't like how I think, I don't like my loss of short-term memory." And she was 47 years old. So we broke it down and tried to understand what was happening in her body that she had not paid attention to. And by the end, there was no more anger. There was only awareness. So here's what Concordia University is saying to us. Anger can be more harmful to an older adult's physical health, older over the age of 50, than sadness. That increases inflammation, which is associated with chronic illness. So being angry, heart disease, anger, arthritis, anger, cancer. And that was published by the American Psychological Association. And this was published in their journal, Psychology and Aging. So just remember, most of the illnesses we suffer from, in fact, probably 90%, from Crohn's disease and ileitis to cancer and diabetes to dementia and Alzheimer's, these are all based upon a chronic, meaning constant, instead of acute, which means momentary but intense, this chronic illnesses that we live with at frequently the subclinical level, meaning it's not enough to stop us from working or having some quality of life, but it's ever present. So we adapt to it. We adapt to our pain. We take pain medication. We adapt to negative situations. We distract ourselves, or we try to block what we can't change with some form of alcohol, drugs, overeating. Nothing gets better that way. So I believe that we should be doing a lot more about anger. I did a film, it's up on the website, you can watch it. It's called Anger Taming the Beast Within. Of the 103 films I've directed, written, produced, and narrated, it's the third most popular. Because we're not taught as a society why we're angry and what to do about it. So it's worth, because anger then creates chronic stress creates cortisol, cortisol creates inflammation, inflammation creates diseases, and diseases limit the quality of our life and substantially shorten our lives. Just something for you to pay attention to. From Thomas Jefferson University, antioxidant properties of NAC and acetylcysteine can halt cancer cell growth. That's a very powerful solution to combat the disease. Last year, 1.7 million new cases of cancer were reported in the United States. It's increasing this year. Plus, hundreds of billions of dollars, thousands of hours spent on treatments, and we're no closer than we were before through the orthodox approach. And here's just a second. I never question the intent, the integrity of the character of someone trying to resolve a problem with a disease. I commend them for that. I would support them if they could show me real evidence that their work is unique and original to the problem, that they're contributing something different. I remember once in one of my doctoral committees, I had nine. Normal person has one, but I was doing the first multidisciplinary degree in the university's history. So they brought in all these other people, and I had to show mastery in each field. And one of the people who was, I believe he was from Ohio State University, he said, "We don't let anyone have the conference of a degree before they prove mastery of field. And I said, well, explain that. Tell me what that means. And he said, well, and we had this discussion, if you're a medical doctor, you cannot provide mastery field. You must do it by what you were told, what the textbooks and the teachings, everyone has to be taught the same information, everyone must take the same test, and you must provide back to the instructor that you know what you were taught. But with a PhD, it's different. A PhD, a doctorate in philosophy, and then especially, you have to show that you have a body of knowledge. Now, what are you contributing that's different? You've got to do something different, original, something that allows an authentic growth, an awareness, a deeper understanding. Big difference, because we're always making the medical doctor degree more significant than the PhD, when in point of fact, it's just the opposite when it comes to what it really represents for the field. And if I were to teach in medical school, and I've taught continuing education to medical doctors, actually for their credit, for their additional credits, I would insist that you not have one standard medical paradigm, because what if it's wrong? And it is wrong. Deadly wrong. Well-intentioned, frequently idealistic, young people go into medicine, and I commend them. And they're overburdened. They're not given a chance to challenge. They're supposed to obey, to be so obedient to the protocols they're given that even when they're failing, they're still rewarded and they're not allowed to change it. And so what if we gave them the same type of educational standard that you have for a doctorate, where you have to prove that you're contributing to a field? Would you be the one then who says chemotherapy may work in some cases with a small percentage of cancers like clear cell adenoma and testicular cancer and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma? Yeah, it will work. But for 80% of other cancers, solid cancers and organic cancers, cancer of the brain, the lung, the skin, the prostate, the breast, the uterus, it doesn't work. It fails miserably. It contributes at least half of all deaths are from the treatment itself. Reasonable and responsible, intelligent people would see that immediately, not wait 50 years and not even be allowed to question it. But it's all based on who controls the curriculum, who controls the paradigm, because the paradigm is what everyone's a part of. So if we're not allowed to challenge the paradigm, then we have to accept it if we're going to be a part of it and rewarded from it and protected by it, because the paradigm protects you. When was the last time you heard anyone criticizing the deep state, including the ones that historically had the courage and the temerity to challenge it, the liberal community? I was a strong member of that liberal community. I believed in it. I fought for it. But at the same time, I saw it become corrupted, and I left it. That's why I founded the Progressive Radio Network, because we look for the truth. We don't care where it's at. We're not aligning ourselves with any ideology. We're aligning ourselves with the truth and what is the betterment for all people, not just one group over another. Now, you would think that people strongly aligned with one particular principle would see the strengths and weaknesses in that principle and let go of the weaknesses and bring in strengths from other areas. They won't do it. They become ideologues. They become rigidified. They're like in a cult or an ultra-orthodox belief system. They won't change it, even when it works against them. That's medicine today. All of medicine today. That's dentistry today. That's dietetic sciences today, which is not a science any longer. Wasn't even when I was becoming a dietitian. That's most of education today. That's our body politic today. That is finance today. That is energy production today. Even the so-called New Green Deal is supporting nuclear power. Now, I'm giving them the complete benefit of a doubt. I commend them on wanting for us to have renewable resources. Have they done the research in Germany about how costly it is and how it's failed? Are they looking at the consequence of what it takes to create a windmill? How long the windmill lasts? Is it really energy efficient? Have they taken a look at solar and how much solar costs and how much energy it requires and how much resource it takes out of nature to produce solar? Or are they just looking at the solar panel on a house and saying that's what we should all have and not looking what it takes to put it there? The real renewable sources we haven't even touched. Wave power that's completely non-polluting, does not disrupt the environment it's in, and is not costly. And geothermal, which costs next to nothing, has an endless supply. And if you looked at what other countries using geothermal would do, you'd say that's a reasonable approach. But when you codify a belief, renewables, and you then put it into a larger paradigm, corporatized and capitalized, then you have a capitalist economic system controlling a paradigm that controls the research, that controls the dialogue, that controls the media, that controls what you do, and you end up with one obese, mind-dead Al Gore owning a $7 billion hedge fund and being one of the biggest users of electricity in the United States and talking only truth to one point of reference, one tiny piece of a puzzle, because that's what he profits from. That's medicine. That's Wall Street and financing. We'll give you a loan on a home, but we will lie, and you will lie that you can afford that when you can't, a liar's loan. We'll give you a credit card even though you're deep in debt. You don't have enough money to pay back the credit card, and we know that, and we're hoping that you can't pay it back so we can increase your interest. And today, or yesterday, Bernie Sanders and Cortez says maximize their profit at 15%. Now think of that for a moment. It's now 18%. But you get 2% back when you buy something. You still owe 16%. That's 1,600% profit, because what did they pay for the money that they're giving you to use? Zero interest. The Federal Reserve, quantitative easing, made sure that. So do you think it's reasonable to charge a poor American that doesn't have a job 1,600% interest? My God, the lack of insight and intelligence in Sanders and some of these other people, it's mind-numbing. This is this group, corporate, or group think without doing the homework, without doing your detail. You're not doing your research. You're not using or bringing in the real independent scholars to show you it shouldn't be 15%, because that's 1,500% profit to the card company, and they know, and you should know. You should have enough intelligence in the two of your brains put together to know that the average American who needs a credit card is not doing it for disposable income, but they're doing it because they pay their rent, they pay for food, they pay for their car payment, they pay for their health insurance with their credit card because they don't have enough savings in the bank account. When 100 million Americans don't have $500 in their savings account, then you know they're not going to be able to pay it. And immediately the backup and compounding interest kicks in. And these are the people that we want to run the country, run Congress, be president? My God, what have we become? A nation of idiots. Functional idiots. We function without thinking. Doctors function without thinking. They'll see every one of their patients go downhill and die from chemotherapy. Will they change? They can't, even if they want to. Because they bought into a paradigm, and the paradigm controls the system, and the system is given the education, and the education is provided by special interest groups, and the special interest groups make sure that the only therapy you use is one that they profit from. So now you're saying, let's go green, nuclear. And I'm saying nuclear is one of the biggest environmental disasters in the world. Show me where you're putting the depleted uranium. There is no place. Show me how they're safe. Every single nuclear plant from Hanford to the Diablo Canyon to Three Mile Island to every single one of them are leaking radiation. Cancer clusters, breast cancer in particular, around every single one. If I can find that out and write a scientific paper on it with Dr. Ernest Turnglass and Dr. Jay Gould, why can't they read that paper? Why can't they find it? The trouble is they can. That's intentional neglect. Because if you're intentionally neglectful, then you stay intentionally ignorant, and therefore you can, with plausible deniability, say, well, we didn't know a nuclear plant living within 50 miles causes a tripling of breast cancer. Who knew? Did you want to know? We didn't know that it's so expensive that for any nuclear plant that you would build, you could have the entire community with geothermal. If you live near the water, you could have it with wave power. Now imagine then applying uniqueness of field so you couldn't become a medical doctor until you showed that there was a better way of treating patients, diagnosing patients, and that it wasn't about defensive medicine, it was about preventive medicine. It wasn't about an orthodox therapy, but it's rather about what is the therapy that does least harm and is most likely to succeed without concern of being punished by your little Gestapos, your little state stupid medical boards with the functionally intoned understandings of what represents true healing. Just a thought. And so here we have, in this one study from Thomas Jefferson University, N-acetylcysteine slows down the growth of cancer. Will they use it? No. Can they use it? Yes. Secretly? What if you were able to help every patient with cancer, with NAC? That's fine, but better keep it quiet, because those who would immediately look at you as being a domestic physician agitator, you will not be rewarded for healing what orthodoxy cannot heal. You'll be punished. That's our system. Shouldn't we be changing the system by withdrawing our support? And from King's College London, does sunscreen compromise vitamin D levels? Yeah. This is published in the British Journal of Dermatology. It's saying you start putting all those sunscreens, which I don't recommend because they're toxic, and toxic ingredients from your sunscreen go into your skin within about 60 seconds. But it also inhibits the body's production of vitamin D, which you need. Also, there's a study from, this is from Ritsumeikan University in Japan, that shows that there are chemicals in ginseng, and one in particular called panaxitrile, it improves protein synthesis for exercise. So the takeaway message is, when you're taking ginseng, you're having a greater ability to exercise. That was published in Nutrition Research. And finally, for teens, online bullying, which is rampant, worsens sleep and depression. How bad is it? Nearly 15% of high school students report being bullied online. And teens who experience cyberbullying are more likely to suffer from poor sleep, which in turn raises level of depression, makes it more difficult to study, and creates a sense of low self-esteem, and that's not good. So we should work upon the solution. The solution should be multi-pronged. For example, why would someone want to bully other people? What is the psychology that creates a pathological approach to communicating? We don't talk about it. We should. We talk about the consequences, but never the underlying cause. And what can we do to block teens from receiving that kind of toxic input? Just like parents can block certain things from their children seeing online, we should be able to create an algorithm that blocks harassment and trolls and agent provocateurs. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 25 minutes into the program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, before we go to our guest, we're going to go to one person who this morning, about an hour ago, came to me and said, I want to share some thoughts. So I said, come on the air. Take your time. Say what you have to say. Now, when you consider a retreat, you think of eating good food, exercising, de-stressing, going home and feeling better about the experience. And in most cases, that's what happens. But what happens when you come to a retreat, the kind of retreat I do, and this is to support our sister station, WBAI, because this will go to pay for, 1,000 premiums. So you'll get your premiums immediately because of this retreat. You won't have to wait months or not get them at all. They're going out right away next week. So what if there's something else that happens at a retreat that you won't find anywhere else in the world? You're going to hear whatever she has to say in a moment.
My name is Gilletta, and this is our first retreat. I brought my son, Quinnell, who is suffering from MS for the past 14 years. He's 31. He was diagnosed when he was 17. We've been to every doctor as the disease progressed, and he started becoming more and more debilitated by it. The only suggestions or recommendations they could give us were medication, even to the point where for his spasms that are so severe, they're like rigor mortis has set in because he becomes so stiff. They said the only thing they could do is put a baclofen pump in his stomach to stop that from happening. We refused all of these things, obviously, and we're here. We've known about Gary for 30 years plus, and we finally got a chance to experience what it's like to live this healthy living that contributes also to my son's lessening of his disease and then the symptoms of it. Since we've been here, just after the first day, the nystagmus in his eyes, which is a tremor that comes about as a result of the MS, where his eyeballs shake profusely, where he can't see, everything is in vibration, they stopped. He no longer experiences that. He can see straight with nothing moving for the first time. He sees vivid colors. Gary's got the most beautiful peacocks roaming the grounds here, and my son was able to identify every color in the peacock's tail, something he hasn't been able to do for 13 years. His hand tremors and the spasms that the doctors wanted to put pumps in his stomach for, well, they're gone, and we haven't taken any tremor medication since Tuesday. I could go on and on about the miraculous things that have happened. He's got his posture, his sitting posture is more stable. He can stand now erect. He's 6'2", and the doctor, when they saw how tall he was, everybody was like, he's a beast, because you can't tell when he's sitting in the wheelchair. He's 6'2", and he's able to stand erect with little assistance, with just someone holding him, but his own legs were standing him up. First time in years. He's also speaking more fluidly. People with MS tend to have the tremors in their neck and their face and their jaw, and my son was experiencing all that as well. Now his jaw is not tremoring. His neck doesn't tremor. He can speak fluidly. His thoughts are more clear. He's also he doesn't need any of the medication that we were giving him anymore. He's now taking only the supplements since we've been here, and it's just been amazing. It's been amazing. Well, it's the end stage, yes. End stage MS, where he's got MS that's the called relapsing remitting. That's the name that's been put on it because it goes and it comes, but then when it comes back, it comes with a vengeance, and when it leaves, it leaves some residual damage. And his has turned to relapsing remitting progressive, where they're saying that there was no reversing of it, there was no remitting anymore. Any damage that he had was going to be permanent damage until one doctor told us, why do you want to do anything for him? He's not going to get better until he dies. And so we obviously told that doctor that he could no longer work on my son because he didn't have hope, and we did. We just didn't know where the help was going to come from, but we knew it was out there. And so he was at the stage where now there's nowhere else to go but toward his death. And he's now reversing. These things are being reversed. And he's doing things he wasn't able to do before. We're even seeing signs where certain ailments that he had that were physical, flu bugs and things like that, and things that have been a part of his history, are not even there anymore. And this is just the road to beginning to switch, to turn the clock back to when he was a 17-year-old young man that was diagnosed with MS. As he was graduating from high school, a water polo captain of his team and a lifeguard, you know, architecture major, like I said, when he went into college, and who can now have that life back. He said to me the other day that now he wants to go back to architecture. He changed his major to social work, which he still wants to do, but he thought he would never be able to draw again. Yesterday, he painted in the art class. He was able to draw a picture in the art class. And this is a young man that at 6 years old, he was drawing like an expert and feeding himself. It goes on. I can't even remember all the stuff. Other people have to remind me of things that have changed. I just took a video of him outside. We're having breakfast, and he was able to drink from a cup. Little things that we take so lightly in our lives, and these are things that are major for this young man. And he sat there, and he thinks I'm such a big ham because I'm always pulling out my video camera, and he gets so embarrassed. But I had to videotape him drinking from a cup like he was a two-year-old just doing it for the first time. And these are just some of the things. I'm sure we're going to be noticing other things as the days progress, as the weeks progress. And he used a fork with a didn't trimmer. Before he could use it, but he'd have to stab the food and he'd have to chase it around his plate because he couldn't, you know, get it. But without a tremor, he could, with focus and purpose, intentionally put the fork into food and lift it to his face and eat it. He was able to, a couple of days ago, eat soup with a spoon without splashing it all over the place. And he was doing this with methodic. It was just methodic and so systematic, like he had been doing it all his life, and he's not been doing these things for 14 years. And this is 1 week. 1 week. We didn't even come for the 2 weeks. If we had been here for 2 weeks, he'd be walking out of here. We'd leave the wheelchair at Gary's spot. You know, you just have to, like, throw it away somewhere for us. Because this is 1 week, not even a whole week, just since Monday, and it's now Friday. 5 days. 5 days we've made this kind of increase. Oh, yes, his beard. When we first got here, he couldn't touch his face. He jokes about it. He says if he touched his face, he might knock himself out because the tremors are so bad. He hits himself so hard when he tries to do things. He's hit me quite a few times. I think it's payback from when he was a little kid, but he gets over with it because of the tremors. But the tremors were so bad, he couldn't touch his face. He's been growing a beard for the past 6 years. Now, mind you, he's had MS for 14, and the tremors have disabled him from being able to even touch his beard. Well, he touched his beard for the first time. I couldn't get him out of the mirror today because he's brushing his beard so many times when he wasn't able to do that before without someone assisting him. You know, he's able to bend over. His core strength has even gotten better. I'm usually afraid when he bends over past his wheelchair because he'll topple over. Well, he's bending over to pick things up off the ground sideways and bringing himself back to a sitting position because he's so much stronger now. Last night, for the first time in I don't know how long, without any medications or anything adding to his this being able to happen, he was up until 10 o'clock, vivid. Usually he's toast by 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock. His energy has waned. He's wiped out. He had so much energy from things that Gary has helped us see and do and just the diet that he's on. I don't want to talk about some of his other bodily functions that have increased as well when it comes to excreting and things like that. But that's even being happening without AIDS, without the aid of any medication. And he was in the pool, the saltwater pool. And now that was the first day he got here, and he wasn't even able to sit up straight in the pool. He needed two, you know, muscle-bound men to keep him sitting erect in the pool. But he was able to do it. He was buoyant enough to be able to move around. And the person who was holding him up in the pool that day, one of the guys saw him and said it was just a miracle that he was able to sit up straight when he couldn't even sit in the pool. Something very minor that most of us do every day when we greet people, we shake their hand. My son has never been able to shake anyone's hand. He was an architecture major in school, and he was studying, drawing, doing everything, and he had a severe attack 14 years ago when all this onset took place, and it caused right-side paralysis. That's why the tremors are so much worse on the right side than they are anywhere else. Well, my son can shake your hand today. Amazing, amazing. From the day we got here, in only 1 week's time, we're going back home with all of these major improvements and increases in his ability. Nobody's going to believe it. I'm sure the doctors won't, but we're certainly going to tell them. And we're so grateful to have been here and been a part of this. I don't want to get choked up again, but this major, people need to know that there's a way to reverse disease. They told us that this MS was not curable, that my son would have it until that he would die with it, and that he would have to take medications for the rest of his life to keep it abated, to keep it from continuing to attack him. And here in this week, we've shown in this 5 days that the medication hasn't been needed, the diet and the things that he's been doing. He's even been in the gym. I didn't even mention this. We went to the gym yesterday. He's lifting barbells, 10-pound barbells. He's like, Mom, the wheelchair is in the way. I can't do the exercise I really want to do. Amazing, amazing. So we're going to continue this protocol, this way of living. This is also a young man, as I must add. Remember, he was 17 when he was diagnosed. I tried to do everything I could. I knew this healthy way of living. It helped me. Gary's protocols actually helped me cure sarcoidosis almost 30 years ago, just following the things that he suggested and recommended before I even knew him. I knew him vicariously through someone else, a close friend of mine who introduced me to his work. And I just implemented it sight unseen. I knew I didn't want to take medication, and it 2 years later, I was running 7 miles where I couldn't even walk a flight of stairs when I first was diagnosed. My son knew this. He lived through it with me. He was 6 years old when it happened. But he was a young man when he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And there's something to be said for youthful indiscretion. He just was not ready to make that commitment at that time. So I would make his meals for him, freeze them, and send them to Hampton University where he was going to school. And he would give the food away because he wanted pizza and sodas and all that stuff. So he was constantly working against me with. And unbeknownst to him, he didn't know any better. He just knew that this is what he wanted to do as a teenager. Well, here it is. Yes, last year he said to me, finally, Mom, I'm ready. I would still put little things in, like I make him spaghetti, and I'd say, after he'd eat it, I'd say, you know, that wasn't real meat. That was vegan. Oh, my, you got me again. And I would do these things, and I would constantly give him supplements and integrate other things, even though we were keeping him on the medication because that was keeping him at bay at that time because he wasn't ready. But last year he said, Mom, I'm ready. I think he got to his wit's end. He realized the doctors told him there's nothing else they can give him, nothing else they can do, and his frustration got him to the point where he was ready. And here we are a year later, and he is just so happy. He's never going back, Gary. He's never going back. He's saying, Mom, okay, we got to go shopping as soon as we get off the plane. It's going to be 9 o'clock at night. I don't know what Whole Foods will still be open by the time we get there, but we're going to have to go shopping and get him all the fruits and things he needs to keep his life going the way it's been going. Thank you, Gary. We love you. Thank you.
What do you think of that? That's what happens in a different paradigm, a different belief system. Yesterday, I spoke with a woman, and she had stage 4 breast cancer 19 years ago. And the doctor said she would have 3 to 6 months to live. If she took chemotherapy, if she didn't, she would die sooner. And she did her homework and realized she didn't want the chemotherapy. And she got a hold of her friend, who was Luann Panessi. And Luann got a hold of me, and I created a protocol. She followed the protocol, and a year later she had no cancer. And her doctor, and I just found this out yesterday, the doctor said that you're the only case of a confirmed stage 4 breast cancer, plus she had a massive tumor in the middle of her chest, aside from the breast cancer, that had reversed it without chemotherapy. How'd you do it? Gave him the protocol. The woman gave the protocol. And he was, I believe it was North Shore Hospital. I don't know which hospital it is out there. I'm not familiar with them. Anyhow, he was saying that they were adding an alternative and complementary wing with some protocols, and he would implement it there. I never knew this. Maybe there are people using the protocol out there. Maybe not. I don't know. But the moment you have something happen in any area of life, or we were told it can't happen, at the very least, we should be curious, critical in our thinking, reserve judgment till we investigate it properly. Remember, every scientist, engineer in the world said it is not humanly possible for a body to go faster than a 4-minute mile. And then one day in the 1950s, a man named Bannister, Roger Bannister, did a 358 something, and he did it. Within 11 days, many other people did it also. What were they waiting for? To let someone know it could be done. And I believe that until you create a different mindset and change your perception of what is possible, you're locked in to a self-limiting, even with good intentions, a self-limiting belief system. That said, let's say hello to my guest who is standing by out in Colorado, Professor David Loy, L-O-Y. I mentioned earlier in the program, he is a professor, philosopher, ethicist, Zen Buddhist teacher, prolific author. And his latest book is Echo Dharma. That's D-H-A-R-M-A, Buddhist Teachings for the Ecological Crisis. His website is davidloy.org. Nice to have you with us today, David.
Well, thank you, Gary, for this invitation.
We're going to be addressing the crisis humanity now faces with runaway climate change and our ongoing destruction of the environment from our civilization's addictions to fossil fuel and exploitation of resources, our rampant consumerist behaviors, and a global economy that fosters inequality and poverty. So I'm simply concerned that we as a society at all levels are not fully grasping the totality of our predicament. Only individual micro elements such as a tornado here, a flood there, a hurricane there, some starvation there, some migration there, some extinction of species here and there, but none of it coming together to form a picture of what we have done. And since I work with counseling individuals with serious life-threatening health conditions, you just heard one. A woman came. By the way, when they came, I've never met these people. The son's hands were in a claw-like position, which is common. He was in excruciating pain, as many people with multiple sclerosis are, because their muscles constrict. Couldn't shake the hand, was shaking very, very strongly. His eyes going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. He couldn't see. Hasn't seen in 14 years. And by the next day, he had no tremors. And he said to his mom, he said, "I knew you were beautiful. Now I see how beautiful you are." First time in 14 years. Now, for the average person, they may not understand that something had shifted. How it shifted, I never discuss what I do, ever. But the fact that there was a change. Now this person has only improved, as you might have heard. He's feeding himself for the first time with a fork and a spoon. I'm sitting there watching him, able to stand up out of a wheelchair, able to lift weights, able to shave himself. He hadn't touched his face because he would hit himself. And it's a different paradigm. So if you're coming to any problem, including look at the environment, with a mindset that does not allow you to see the totality of a problem, and hence a different approach to the problem, then we're limited. So would you please take us on this journey of showing us how a new moral and ethical compass is needed that values universal truths, and so that we can have a better understanding of how to deal with climate change in ways we wouldn't otherwise. The forum is yours.
Thank you. Well, I think you've certainly put your finger on it, that the problem isn't just a matter of switching from fossil fuels to renewables as quickly as possible, although that's definitely part of it. But I tend to see that as just the tip of a much larger iceberg, which includes the rest of the ecological crisis. Thinking about the sixth great extinction event, we've had a lot of news recently about how many species seem to be going extinct. And I remember E.O. Wilson predicting some time ago, the renowned Harvard biologist, saying that by the end of this century, perhaps half of all plant and animal species on Earth could have gone extinct or be so close to extinction, so weakened that they'd go extinct soon thereafter. And then if you add to that so many other things, I mean, plastics, which, you know, really have only been around for one lifetime. I mean, they didn't really become that prevalent until the 50s, and suddenly they're everywhere, including in the air and in the water that most of us drink. Adding to that all the toxins in the air, the water, the earth, in our bodies, and it's a pretty remarkable sort of confluence of problems we've got, even ignoring the larger or other social issues. The problem of our economic system, this incredible and still growing gap between the rich and the poor, the kind of political problems that seem to be aggravating now with the recent taking of power of so many strongmen. I mean, what it really seems to be happening, if we look at the whole rather than just one part of it, we really do seem to have a civilization that's lost its way. It seems to be ironic that just at the time when we've achieved a truly global civilization, it seems to be self-destructing. And so one of my concerns as a Buddhist scholar and teacher and writer is to reflect on what it is that the Buddhist tradition may have to offer that can help us understand and respond to this. There's a number of things that Buddhism, I think, can offer here, but one that stands out for me in particular is what I see as a rather interesting and profound parallel between what Buddhist teachings have been saying about our individual predicament, our usual individual predicament, and our collective situation today. It really does come down to, as you said, a new paradigm, a new worldview, a new understanding of who we are in relation to other people. Buddhism has always emphasized that the sense of separate self that most of us have, in fact, that there's something delusive about it, the idea of separation, that in fact, once you really start to look at it, we're not separate. We're all interdependent. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about interbeing and the fact that the world really isn't a collection of separate things, but really more processes, and each of those processes is dependent on all the others, and we too are part of those processes. So for Buddhism, one way to understand the fundamental problem that we have is this delusive sense of separation, and therefore the delusion that my individual well-being is separate from the well-being of other people and indeed the rest of the world generally. So that's something that Buddhism has sort of been emphasizing ever since it was established some 2,500 years ago. But what I think is fascinating today is to see the parallels between that and our collective predicament, which is to say, I think it really comes down to a very similar sense of separation or alienation, I suppose you could call it, between ourselves as a species, as a now global civilization, and the rest of the biosphere. We really do feel that we're separate from the biosphere, and that therefore, again, our well-being is somehow separate from its own well-being, and therefore we can treat it as sort of a collection of resources to be exploited and a big dump for us to dump our refuge into. So just as on the individual level for Buddhism, there's a lot of emphasis on overcoming this delusive sense of separation, which is how Buddhist practices can be basically understood. So what we really need today is to realize our non-duality with the earth, you know, that the earth isn't just the place where we happen to be. It's not even just our home. It's our mother. But in a sense, it's even more profound because we never really cut the umbilical cord when you think about our need to breathe, our need to drink, our need to eat. We really are one of the many manifestations of the earth, and in order for us to live healthily on it, we have to realize that and act in a way that works for the well-being of the whole. What we're realizing today, I think the ecological crisis in general is something that will only be really resolved if we can come to that realization, if we can realize that, you know, when the earth gets sick, we're going to get sick. And if the earth loses some of its ecosystems, likewise, we're going to have a very similar problem. So this is really what ecodharma is all about. Buddhism traditionally hasn't had much to say about this because, of course, at the time Buddhism developed, this wasn't the problem. But interestingly, it's not so difficult, I think, to extrapolate some of the implications as I've just tried to do and use those to understand our predicament today.
I appreciate those insights. When I work with people, I generally work with terminally ill people, people who've been given up. Their doctors say there's nothing more that can be done. Mm. Now we're looking at an environment that is terminally ill. And we've detached ourselves from the causes of our negative emotions and changing our detrimental behaviors and habits and acquiring instead a fatalistic view of life or an indifferent view of life instead of a positive outlook on life and nurturing happiness, nurturing joy, and spending time in nature and many more things we could be doing that authentically connect us to universal truths and nature instead of seeing that nature is only there as an appendage of our needs from time to time. We never ask ourselves, where does our food come from? How does it start? Who plants it? What are the conditions they're faced with? What happens when there's a crisis to them, such as Nebraska, where a million animals died in a couple hours or a couple days and it was flooded? The whole state was ruined. And we don't ask ourselves because we can go to the store and buy food from another place. So the sacrifice and suffering that Nebraskan farmers had to make to give us our food, we just find someone else and we don't connect with their suffering. What happens when we as a society, through Buddhist mindset, disconnect from the suffering of a planet, the suffering of a species, the suffering of the orangutans that have lost their habitat because we want that oil, that palm oil, to put in our crackers and cakes? What responsibility do we have for being stewards of this earth, a planet that is largely sick and a population that is pathologizing that sickness? Your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I think there's a really important parallel between what Buddhism has traditionally said about desire or craving, right? I mean, many of us understand that the solution to our unhappiness is a matter of achieving satisfaction of our desires. And, you know, the fundamental Buddhist teaching there is that desires are endless and you're never going to be able to do that. Unfortunately, today, you know, we live in an economic system which continues to grow and profit from the fact of constantly persuading us that it's the next thing that we buy that's going to make us happy. And, of course, that doesn't work. What Buddhism emphasizes instead of that is, first of all, realizing the wisdom of our interconnectedness, as I was saying before, that we're connected with the earth, that our well-being is not separate from from the well-being of those animals and farmers in Nebraska, because we're not separate from them and because we're not separate from the earth. So Buddhism emphasizes that realization of what you might call non-duality or oneness. But the other side of it is the compassion that should be manifested when we realize that. One of my favorite quotations is from an Indian teacher, Nisargadatta, who said, "When I look inside and see that I'm nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love." Or as we would say in Buddhism, compassion. And I love that quote because he sort of shows so clearly the relationship between the two. Wisdom realizing that I'm not separate, and compassion is actualizing that in how we actually live. What I think is interesting about our situation today is that the way that compassion needs to manifest is rather different than it would have traditionally. When you look at sort of Asian Buddhism, the emphasis on compassion came forth as, you know, helping other people wake up and occasionally maybe responding to some natural disaster. But what's pretty clear today is we have a situation where we also need to address the systemic causes of the kind of situation that we're in today. As you pointed out, the issue is, a lot of the issue is worldview, but that worldview is sort of concretized or institutionalized in some very problematic structures. And again, there's a really fascinating parallel here with earlier teachings, traditional teachings, because Buddhism traditionally doesn't talk about evil, but it has a lot to say about what's sometimes called the three poisons: greed, ill will, and delusion. And I think when we look at our situation today, I think we can see that they've become institutionalized. I think, frankly, our economic system, which is so dependent on promoting consumerism in order to keep growing, I think that's become institutionalized greed to a large extent. When you look at,
I would absolutely agree.
Yeah,
David. Unfortunately, we're out of time for this discussion. I'm going to invite you back for 4 hour because this deserves a 4 hour. So I hope that you would join us on a progressive commentary to go into greater depth on this topic.
I'd be delighted to do that, and I'm sorry I'm so long-winded today. But thank you for this invitation, Gary.
You're not long-winded. You have very important messages for us, including what Buddhism shares with us. It is that show love and respect for all sentient beings, including trees and nature and animals and humans. The website is davidloy.org, and his latest book is Echo Dharma, Buddhist Teachings for the Ecological Crisis. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.